She just died the previous year. You know, it was 1964. God Experience by Swami Ramdas. The late Swami Ramdas was that rare phenomenon of a bhakta or devotee who won through by sheer force of devotion to at least glimpses of identity. There was a spirit of love and purity and an all-pervading happiness in his ashram. Fittingly, was it called Ananda Ashram. Many appreciated particularly the evening hours when he would sit amid his disciples talking to them in English, laughing and joking, mingling reminiscence with Upadesha, spiritual instruction. Fortunately, a disciple took down these talks over a period and made a book of them, which was published under the name God Experience, just about the time the Swami left us. Sometimes he speaks as a pure bhakta, quote, unless you have a burning aspiration for God, the mind cannot be fixed on him. Where your love is, there your mind is. Just as a miser constantly thinks of money and money alone, so a devotee has exclusive devotion to God. When you have intense love for God, everything else is forgotten. Then you will realize God. Sometimes again, he speaks from the point of view of identity and shows how devotion can lead to it by its very intensity. Quote, your search for God is your search for the Atma, Atman, or Self. At the end of your search, you will realize that you are He. You start with duality and end in non-duality. Then you know that you have been seeking, then you know that you have been seeking your own self, thinking that the self was different from you. Ultimately, you know you are that self itself. There ends your quest. This is a book full of love and understanding, the outpourings of a true saint. Aspirants are recommended to keep it by them and dip into it again and again for solace in moods of depression and for invigoration when the way seems hard. There's very little in it that is technically Hindu, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim. All will find it helpful.
That was a brief review.
Well, I skipped a paragraph or two.
Okay.
So, you know, that time, a lot of books used to come out in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Remember Samuel Weiser.
Yeah. And there was another one, Oriental Books, was upstairs, around 14th Street and 3rd Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
He had one, The Incredible Sai Baba. He just finished it, yeah. The Golden Master, composed by the eminent poet Harindranath Chattopadhyaya in the ashram hall, crowded with devotees, on the night when death had claimed the body of Sri Ramana. Grief hath grown silent with its own excess and will not weep lest it betray his trust. Even in this dark hour of dire distress, he lights the flame of knowledge through our dust, illumining its blindness wide and far. He glitters from his heaven of deathless grace in every speck and stone, in every star. We see the lonely wonder of his face. Ignorance rumors that our king departs. Where can he go? Oh, where? The being moans. He who has made rich kingdoms of our hearts and of our thoughts his countless jeweled thrones. May he forgive our wavering faith, forgive the folly of our doubts whose eyes are dim. How dare we move or breathe except through him? How could we live if he should cease to live? They're all been done now. They used to sell all these advertisements.
Yeah,
that used to be that how they used to fund it. And all these people mostly were devotees or something, you know, they had businesses and they would pay for an advertisement. You know, someone, AVM production, symbol of superb motion pictures, which exhibit screens with pride and confidence. I don't know, you know.
Yeah, lots of them.
Like shipping company and Kilo Sarkar, electric company in Bangalore. Electric motors, transformers, alternators, welding generators. You know, who's reading this will be interested in all this. But they would go around to these people they know and get them to. Here they're doing. Many readers of the mountain path, especially among those who were not fortunate enough to come to Bhagavan in his lifetime, are avid for reminiscences about him. All devotees are former visitors who have any such that have not yet been published are requested to send them to the editor who will give them his earnest consideration. They will be performing a real service to many of Bhagavan's devotees and thereby indirectly to Bhagavan himself. Persons who have received the blessings or guidance of Bhagavan in dream or vision, whether before or after he shed the body, are also requested to write in their experiences. True Silence by Nagama. At 3 o'clock this afternoon, I joined the company of devotees around Bhagavan. Reverting to what he had been saying earlier about Sri Shankara's Dakshinamurti Ashtakam, Bhagavan said Shankara took it into his head to praise Dakshinamurti. But how can one praise Mona? Silence. So he described Srishti, creation, Stiti, preservation, and Laya, dissolution, and offer salutations to Dakshinamurti, who is the embodiment of all three. In what other way could silence be praised? Taking up the thread of the conversation, one devotee said, Dandapana Swami told us that one Shivaratri day, many years back, all the devotees gathered around Bhagavan and sat down, saying, today, Bhagavan must explain to us the meaning of the Dakshinamurti Ashtakam. However, Bhagavan sat silent for a long while, smiling but not speaking. They then went away, feeling that Bhagavan, by his continued silence, had given them to understand that silence alone is the true meaning of the verses. Is that so? Bhagavan confirmed that it was so. I then added, so that means that Bhagavan gave a silent commentary, and Bhagavan confirmed this also. Someone else said, then true silence means abiding in the self, doesn't it? Bhagavan, yes, of course. Without the self, how could it be silence? Devotee, that is just what I'm asking. Would it be silence just to refrain from speaking without abiding in the self? Bhagavan, how could it be? Some people talk of keeping silence when all the while they keep on writing messages on bits of paper or on a slate. Isn't that activity of the mind just the same? Another devotee intervened. And then, is there no benefit at all from simply refraining from speech? Bhagavan, a person may refrain from speech in order to avoid the obstructions of the outer world. But he should not suppose that that is an end in itself. True silence is really endless speech. There's no such thing as attaining it, because it is always there. All you have to do is to remove the worldly concerns that cover it over. There is no question of attaining it. In the meantime, news came that some broadcasting society was thinking of recording Bhagavan's voice. Laughing, Bhagavan said, "Oh ho, is that so? But my voice is silence, isn't it? How can they record silence? That which is silence. Who could record it?" The devotees sat quiet, exchanging glances, and the hall became absolutely silent. Footnote. Silence in the presence of Bhagavan had no feeling of constraint about it. It was a living, vibrant silence. It was in silence, but the power of his presence and the emanation of his grace was most keenly felt. The same is to be felt now also. Editor. Bhagavan, the embodiment of Dakshinamurti, sat in the Mona Mudra, the posture of silence, facing southward. Footnote. One meaning of the name Dakshinamurti is the southward facing. The Guru is the spiritual north pole, and therefore traditionally faces south. That living image, his body, was radiant with the light of Atma. What a good day it was today. How I Met the Maharshi by Lewis Hartz. I met Arthur Osborne in an internment camp in Bangkok during the Second World War. At first I had little contact with him because he was very reserved. A lot of British are like that. I don't know. I met some. There's this, one of my neighbor's daughters went to England from Nova Scotia, and she was a midwife. And she got a job there. And she was on the bus in London, and the bus was going by something and reminded her of Nova Scotia, and she started telling the person all about that and how it's like in Nova Scotia and the similarities and everything. All of a sudden, she noticed that everybody in the bus was looking at her. I mean, nobody else was talking, you know? So they're usually very reserved.
John Cleese said they lived their life trying to avoid being embarrassed.
That sounds like. After some time, however, I approached Arthur Osborne. I had a craving to understand and ask him point blank, "What is truth?" Now, why would he think of that in an intern camp looking at Arthur Osborne? Maybe there were some discussions he overheard at some point. What sticks in my memory is how, sitting beside his bed in the common dormitory, he said, you know, they were interned by the Japanese during World War II. He was a college professor, you know, this Arthur Osborne. Then he got caught. He couldn't, they didn't, his family left and was already in Tirunelveli. And all, he hadn't gone there yet, but he sent his family there because he heard about Maharshi, because they thought the Japanese might come. He was there for 2 years, I think. By his bedside in the common door, he said, "I will tell you the one truth. Infinity minus X is contradiction in terms because the exclusion of X, the first term, ceases to be infinite." What do you say, Sheldon?
Infinity minus X is infinity.
He agrees. You grant that? Yes, I granted that. Well then, he said, think of God as infinity and yourself as X and try to work it out. Okay, X. When I asked for more explanation, he just said, think this over and come tomorrow at this time and tell me what you make of it. I returned to my place in the dormitory, which was only some 8 or 10 steps distance, and suddenly it flashed upon me that he was right, that you cannot take anything away from the infinite, and that I was not apart from it, only I had not known. The thought made me so happy that I could hardly wait to speak to him the next day, but I did not like to disturb him earlier. From that time onward, he started to instruct me, and after a few weeks, he showed me a photograph of the Maharshi. Now, he had never gone there yet, but he had the photograph. Sent his family there. There was an urgency in his voice as he spoke of him, and he handled the photograph with reverence. I began to understand that there was only one I, and that it was in me, and was everywhere. The Maharshi grew so much in my heart that I felt him nearer to me than my parents or my wife. He lived more vividly in me than any person I had known. After some time, we received permission to write a Red Cross letter to our families, and I used mine to write to the Maharshi and ask him for guidance. Then the war ended, and I left camp. The desire to enjoy life sprang up in me again. I was strongly drawn to the spiritual path, but even more strongly, for the time being, to a worldly life. I wanted to make money, to have power and fine clothes, to be important. In camp, I had eliminated daydreaming as far as possible. When I went to bed at night, I slept straight away. But now my nights were often filled with planning and scheming. A few years later, when I was in Europe, and due to return to Siam on business, I wrote to Osborne, who was living at Tiruvannamalai, to suggest that I should break my journey in India and stay there for a few days. He at once wrote back, arranging to meet me and conduct me there and inviting me to stay at his house. In Madras, we hired a car and drove to Tiruvannamalai. It was an old car, and I felt that I was being slowly roasted in the midday heat. When I let my eyes rest on the sun-baked scenery or the country folk sheltering under the wayside trees, I saw only the face of Maharshi looming up before me. Nothing else registered. I was terribly scared that the Maharshi would look in my eyes and see into me. I cursed myself for a fool for coming to this desolate place with its heat and discomfort. I don't know what prevented me turning back. Perhaps I was afraid to show Osborne what a coward I was. The nearer we approached the ashram, the more I shrank from meeting the Maharshi. It was nearly dusk when we arrived, and he had already retired. But Osborne went in to see him and asked whether he would see me for a few moments. I entered the hall and saw an elderly man reclining on a couch, who gave the impression of great reserve and a certain shyness. It was not the severe master or the guru with the burning eyes that I had expected. Osborne explained who I was, and his replies were monosyllabic and sometimes in Tamil. With a slow movement of the head, he turned to me and held my eyes for a moment. His eyes were like empty, bottomless pools, and at the same time, they worked like magic mirrors, because suddenly I felt at peace, as though I had come home after a long journey. I can't recall where I slept that night, but I do remember that before going to bed, I sat and talked with a number of people, Indians and foreigners, at Osborne's place. One of them was a diplomat from some European country stationed in China. He talked about seeing spirits and even conversing with them. And it struck me as funny that anyone should be interested in such things at a place like this. Sitting in the hall the next day, I saw that the Maharshi's smile was tender and gracious. I not only lost my fears, but felt at ease. I had no questions to ask. Before coming, I had prepared a number of questions that had been worrying me to ask the Maharshi, but now I couldn't remember them. My doubts had simply evaporated. Questions seemed unimportant. I felt that there was nothing strange about the Maharshi. He was just a man who was himself. Whereas all of us were growing away from ourselves. He was natural. It was we who were not. We call him a saint or sage, but I felt that to be like him is the inheritance of everyone. Only we throw it away. There were a lot of people in the hall, Indians and foreigners, learned professors and simple country people. I reminded the Maharshi about the Red Cross letter I had sent him, and he replied that he wanted me to come, and I had come. There was something childlike about him. He was free and natural, and could laugh with the spontaneity that only a child shows. A discussion started in the hall, and they appealed to the Maharshi to say who was right. Someone spoke about unity, and I objected that the word implied two, to be united, and that a better word was oneness. And the Maharshi confirmed this. He said, there is only one, and that one is indivisible. I felt that he meant that the divisions are unreal, just as we say rain, ice, water, coffee water, washing water, but it is all water. A group of devotees started singing, and I asked the Maharshi what he felt about it. He laughed and replied that it pleased them to sing and made them feel peaceful. Next morning, again, I sat in the hall. There was a yogi with matted hair. The diplomat was there, sitting in concentrated thought. I wondered whether I should imitate him, but I did not feel like meditating. Suddenly the Maharshi looked at me with great intensity. His eyes took possession of me. I don't know how long it lasted, but I felt at ease and happy. Afterward, the disciple who had been with him for 20 years told me that this was the silent initiation. I felt that it probably was, but I wanted to make sure. So in the hall that afternoon, I said, Bhagavan, I want your initiation. And he replied, you have it already. Footnote. This is the editor writing. This is the only occasion on which I have ever known the Maharshi given an express verbal confirmation of having given initiation to anyone. It will be noted that the request was phrased in such a way that the confirmation could be given without any statement implying duality. And he replied, you have it already. Knowing myself and feeling anxious about what would happen when I left his presence, I asked for some sort of reassurance from him. And he replied very firmly and decisively, even if you let go of Bhagavan, Bhagavan will never let go of you. There was some whispering, an exchange of glances when people heard that. The diplomat whispered to a Muslim professor, must have been Dr. Saeed, sitting beside him, and then the latter asked the Maharshi whether this guaranteed applied only to me or to him also. The Maharshi did not look very pleased, but replied briefly, to all. Nonetheless, I felt that there was something intensely personal in it, that it had been a confirmation of the initiation and a direct personal guarantee of protection. Certain it is that, whatever else may have happened, there has been no day since then when his face or his words have not influenced me. Big article on self-inquiry. Samadhi by N.R. Krishnamurti. The inquiry, who am I, plunges the mind into the self. This is not the nescience of sleep. One can abide as the self in Nirvikalpa Samadhi without the body world dream, or in Sahaja Samadhi with this dream simultaneously witnessed. If the Lord Ramana Dakshinamurti chose to declare the supreme state by silence only, it is not for us to attempt a definition in words. It is a part of wisdom to remain still, as our Sri Ramana ordained. Shirk and Tawhid by Abdullah Qutbuddin.
What is it again?
Tawhid.
Shirk and Tawhid.
It says in the Quran that one unforgivable sin is shirk. This means literally association. It implies the association of any other with Allah in one's worship. And one who thus associates is termed mushrik, literally interpreted, a Christian is considered mushrik because he associates Christ and Christ's mother with God in his worship. For most Christians, of course, the Trinity is the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. They don't use that term anymore. They say Holy Spirit. They don't say ghost. In the Catholic Church here, they'll say Holy Spirit. No. And in any case, one who understands the doctrine of the three persons and one God is not a mishrik. The term might, however, fit educationally backward Catholics who pray to saints and the Virgin as well as to God. Understood more profoundly, you know, he was a Muslim for some time. Arthur Osborne.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He took initiation and everything. You know, but he goes on to tell how it's the same as a Dvaita, you know.
Oh, what was a Dvaita?
Like, in Christian terms, he who has no will but God's. What he wants is what happens, and what happens is what he wants. Paradoxically, his obedience to the nature of things is his rule over them. His weakness is all-powerful. And the secret of his power is that he isn't concerned with events at all. Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added unto you. Seek ye first these things, and even they shall be taken away. This perfect obedience isn't just lining oneself up with God's will, or imitating it, or even becoming part of it. It's that very will itself in full operation. If we wish to find out exactly what it's like to make the world, we have only to desire nothing and pay attention. But total acceptance is very hard. It's precisely the opposite of the lazy indifference that merely lets things slide. It springs from inner strength, not weakness, and is the result of concentration, not slackness. Why is the world so troublesome, so frightful? It is like that by nature, or because we make it seem so by our negligence. It is perhaps so terrible, a place because we take the easy way of fighting it instead of the difficult way of fitting in with it. We have to find out ourselves. You know, I don't know. Complicated article. Oh, I know, I jumped. What happened there? I jumped back to a different article. But you can't tell the difference. Okay, then here's a short poem by Arthur Osborne. Ahud. A-H-A-D. Before the beginning, he was. Beyond the ending, he is. Hidden in the heart of man, flared forth in myriad stars and in bird song, unchanged and unbegun, unfellowed, he, the one, the all, he is, the alone, otherness but a dream gone on too long. In The Raging Fire by Sen, it is against the spirit of our age to flee samsara for solitude. It is against the spirit of our age to flee samsara for solitude. Some even ridicule those who do. Yet samsara is a raging fire, and those who fall into it are destroyed. There is on merit in their destruction. There is on merit in their destruction. It is not a sacrifice, but the result of ignorance. Some can remain near the fire without getting scorched, can even use it, but how few? Whether we flee from it or not, the fact remains that it is a fire, samsara. How few can avoid its flames? How few can be like King Janaka? To escape from it is absolutely necessary. Yet in the present age, Bhagavan has assured us that the escape may be an inward one. One way or the other, whether by inner aloofness or by solitude, escape we must. Here's an article by the Dalai Lama, Tibetan Buddhism. It's really good. I remember reading it. You know, he contributed a few articles to this. You know, this is in the 60s. We are grateful to His Holiness for finding time to write this article for the Mountain Path amidst his manifold other preoccupations. Many readers will be interested to see in it a categorical statement from the highest authority that there still are valid initiatic paths in Tibetan Buddhism and qualified gurus among the refugee lamas able to impart guidance on them. It's a long article, so it was a good article. We can read it tomorrow. Putting a lot of poems in here. This is Song of Meditation by Huck Quinn, 1685 to 1768, was the most influential Rinzai Zen master of recent times. His Song of Meditation, or Zazen Wazan, is chanted before formal lectures in Zen monasteries. This translation of it was specially made for the Mountain Path by the American poet Gary Snyder. You know, he's famous. He wrote Gary Snyder. Mm. Lived in Chicago. He's no more now. But. Living beings, Buddhas from the first, without beings, no Buddhas. Not knowing how near, men seek it far off. Like living in water and crying of thirst, like a rich man's child lost in a poor town. The karma of traveling the six realms is the dark road of our own ignorance. Always walking the dark road, when will you leave samsara? This samadhi of the Mahayana is great beyond praise. The paramitas of morality and charity, nambutsu, repentance, and asesis, all sorts of good practice are contained within it. A man who gains the merit of but one meditation destroys the gathered errors of a lifetime. When the evil realms are homeless, the pure land can't be far. How grateful is the man whose ear once hears the law. Praise and adoration gain great good fortune, but one who turns toward this proves his true self directly. True self is no self. This is not idle talk. Cause and effect are one. This opens the gate. No twos or threes. The road is straight. Form of the formless is the form. To go or come, no different place. Thought of the thoughtless is the thought. Song and dance, the Dharma's voice. Samadhi is an open sky. For wisdom's moon is bright and clear. What can there be left to seek? For total stillness has appeared. The very place is the lotus land. This very body, Buddha. You know, Aparna's son, he's studying in Japan.
Oh, yeah?
For a semester.
Mm-hmm.
He learned Japanese, you know, Aparna. Now, he's going to spend a week in the Zen monastery,
oh,
part of his course, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And where the only monks are there. The best, the nicest Zen story I like is about this monk living in a cottage in the forest, and some thief comes. And he says he wants everything. So the monk, you know, gives him whatever's in there. And he says, I want your clothes. So he took off his clothes, he gave him his clothes. It's at night. It's a clear night, you know. And took off his clothes, and the man walked away with everything. And the monk sitting on the porch, with no clothes on, and he's looking up the sky. He said, and the moon is full. And he said, if only I could just give him the moon.
It's really nice, yeah.
Here's another one. Oh, this is our Dilip Kumar life. You know, this Wei Wu Wei, he was living in, he's a Westerner. Arthur Osborne liked him. You know, he was living in Hawaii, I think. Now, there's Joel Goldsmith. He was a Jew from New York. You know, you heard know about him, right?
Yes. Yeah,
and then he became a Christian Scientist.
Okay. What's a Christian Scientist?
You know, they do healings and things, you know. And but then, here's a Joel, then he moved to Hawaii also. Joel Goldsmith of Honolulu. Then he had this international organization, The Infinite Way.
Mm.
So he had some experience, so he left the Christian Science. Joel Goldsmith of Honolulu, Hawaii, is widely known as one of the leading masters of spiritual healing in the world today. His book, The Art of Healing, is a beautiful exposition of this art as a canalization of divine power, with the healer eliminating his own personality. You know, this is a Christian Science thing. They do healing.
They also don't believe, they say that you can't go to a doctor if you get sick, and they won't take their kids if they're...
So, yeah, I don't know how popular it is now. Apart from this, he has a wide influence in many countries through his books and his personal influence, and as a leader of the Infinite Way groups. He gave talks, we used to have cassettes. He gives talks about Christianity and Christ and immortality and things. As this article, written specially for the Mountain Path, will show, the way he advocates is fundamentally the same as that of the Maharshi, since it consists in seeking reality in oneself, not in any books or scriptures or other places or things. He was a very good speaker, you know. I mean, it all came natural to him. It's all long
ago.
What?
He's no more?
Oh, yeah, he died quite a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a little thing by Professor K.R.R. Sutton, The Guide on the Mountain Path. For us who take the mountain path, the Maharshi is the guide. He came to Ramanachala as a boy ascetic in 1900. Well, almost. and for 50 years lived there among us, showing us the way and helping us along it. On April 14, 1958, 47 p.m., a meteor lit up the sky as his mortal remains returned to dust. The living sage of scintillating stillness no longer draws us with his luminous eyes. The hand which fed the cow, the squirrel, the monkey, the crow, and the peacock is no more visible. Yet thousands who recall his soothing stillness and his heart glowing with mercy for love for all still worship at his shrine, each at that level to which the Master has guided him. No more need any doubt the presence of God, for hundreds, thousands have been remolded by him, manifested on earth in the form of Maharshi Ramana. Others who never saw him in this form feel no less his presence as Ramana. He recalled us to that larger dimension of reality to which we belong, as Dr. Radhakrishna calls it. Many of us found, when his eyes pierced into ours, that all our doubts dissolved and disappeared. He still continues to appear to some of us in dreams and visions, and to some also who never saw him in the body. Once when I was enjoying the hospitality of a friend in America, I called on him. O Master Ramana, you who rescued me midway on life's course. And suddenly, spontaneously, all the wisdom of the Upanishads rose up in me in silence. In the Avadhuta Gita, when a pot breaks, the space that was enclosed in it merges with universal space. Similarly, when the mind becomes pure, only the immaculate Atma remains. No differentiation whatever is there seen. And Mira says, Bhakta, human birth is a rare gift. It is difficult to obtain it over again. And then Tukaram, this knowledge is direct. It is so very plain. God is in our grasp, but we have no experience, says Tukaram. Okay. Here's the short one by Tukaram. My speech is silence. Dying I live. Existing I do not exist among the people. And enjoyment is my renunciation. And association, detachment. I have broken all bonds and ligatures. What is a ligature?
It's a tie.
Tukka says, I am not what I appear to be. As Pandaranga, God, if you have anything to ask, go to ask him.
Ask. Are there any voice recordings? No,
nothing. You know, they tried. And they even brought in a reel-to-reel recorder and set up a microphone and put it before Bhagavan. So one person brought it, and he was very hesitant coming into the hall to do it. But he finally did it, and Bhagavan asked him all these questions about how it works, how it records, how it replays, and everything. So he got encouraged, so he set it all up and put it there, and said, Bhagavan, I'm going to record your voice now, and he turned it on, and then they sat there, and like for 15 minutes, Bhagavan didn't say anything. So then they got up, and he got up, and he turned it off, and said, Bhagavan, unless you speak, we can't record your voice. And then Bhagavan said, how can you record my voice? My voice is silence. And then some Muruganar got us, why did you turn it off? At least we could have got him saying that.
True.
Photographs, hundreds, but not...
No voice.
The funny thing is, the first day I came here and I walked in, I didn't even know who Bhagavan was, and I just walked in. when I sat for an hour in meditation, and the only thing I asked him for, can I hear your voice? Mm.
That's the silence. Yep.
Well, they recorded his silence.
That's still going on. You didn't record it now.